Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to another episode of Living Well with Kathleen Saunders, your weekly podcast where we discuss the financial, physical, spiritual, and social well-being of everyday people like you and me. The information shared in this show is for general information purposes only and should not be used to make any personal changes to your lifestyle or health without consulting the appropriate financial, medical, or healthcare professionals. My guest today was born in St. Vincent and the Grenadines and has been living in Quebec since 1968. H. Nigel Thomas is the author of 5 novels, including No Safeguards with Guernica, 3 collections of short fiction, a collection of poems, and 2 academic books. He was twice shortlisted for the Quebec Writers Federation Hugh MacLennan Fiction Prize. In 2000, he received the Montreal Association of Business Persons and Professionals Jackie Robinson Award for Professional of the Year. In 2013, he was awarded Université Laval's Homage au Créateur, and most recently received the Martin Luther King Award. Welcome, Nigel, and thank you so much for being my guest today.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure chatting with you about writing and other issues.
Awesome. You know, I love to read books and have given some thought to writing a book one day. Tell me, what was it that inspired you into the world of writing?
You know, I honestly don't know. Really, honestly don't know. The only thing I know is that I was always in love with words.
Okay.
And every once in a while, my mind flashes back to when I was about 8 years of age. Mm-hmm. And I remember being sent to get the class reader for that particular grade that I was in. And I remember just opening the text and walking from Georgetown to Dixon, about a mile, and just reciting to myself. You know, and I do recall one of those poems by William Blake, piping down the valleys while piping songs of pleasant glee. On a cloud I saw a child, and he laughing said to me, pipe song about a lamb, and so on and so forth. And that was it. I was always in love with words.
Okay.
Love with words.
So you developed a love for reading for words at an early age then?
Very early, yes.
Okay, great. Was there any one person that inspired you with your love of reading? Was there any role model that you saw reading while you picked up that interest?
Oh, yes. My grandfather was an avid reader.
Okay.
I mean, he was full of flaws, but that was one thing that he gave to me, and I treasure him for that. And not only was he himself a reader, but he was always interested in what I was reading.
So at what point does your interest move from reading to writing books?
It's kind of strange. I remember when I was about 10, I wrote a poem and I showed it to a teacher. And she said, you didn't write that, you copied it from a book.
Oh, really?
And I never wrote anything again until I think I was about maybe 17. I wrote a short, an imaginary thing of some boys exploring a cave. And I showed it to an English teacher, and he said, "My, you have a great imagination. I hope you continue to exercise it." And then that was that.
Okay.
And then around 1920, I wrote a couple of short plays for fundraisers, which were performed and which everyone liked, and so on and so forth. I never thought anything of it. In fact, I never kept copies of them. But I truly actually knew I had to write in November of 1975. It was then that I realized it was almost like a religious conversion. It happened to me. I was walking on the top of Mount Royal, and I remember the scene vividly that day. Just extremely vivid scene. And some words came into my head, and I recognized them as poetry, I went home and I wrote them down. And from that point onwards, I found that almost every day for several years, I either had to think about poetry, make notes about writing poetry, or write poetry. And yeah, thus it began.
Wow, awesome. That's amazing. Yeah. That's where you kind of got your inspiration then, on this Mount Royal?
Yeah, yeah, Mount Royal.
Mount Royal, awesome.
Yeah.
So professionally, what was your first piece of writing that you did?
I, in terms of professional writing, it would probably have to be the short stories that are collected in How Loud Can the Village Cock Crow?
Okay.
And the novel Spirits in the Dark. That novel, and I know you have a question about that, but I can answer it now.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
That novel was written, the first version of it was written in 1983. But I didn't feel it was good enough for publication. However, a professor of mine read it and wanted me to publish it. Anyway, he encouraged me to publish a short section of it which is published as At the Market. And that was published in 1983. So technically, in terms of professional publication, actually, I had a poem as well published in an American poetry journal. I think it was called Poetry Today, that was published out of Portland in Oregon. So those were the first two pieces of creative writing. Mm-hmm. That were published, and both of them were published in 1983. Before that, though, I'd had essays, critical essays published. But in terms of creative writing, those were the first two pieces in 1983.
1983, awesome, nice, mm-hmm. nice. So tell me, as a writer, how do you develop your skills?
Well, it is simply, I mean, I'd been studying literature for many, many years. And in a study of literature requires that you pay very close attention to the text. And in paying close attention to the text, you recognize how the writers you're studying use language. Mm-hmm. And language is used for a given end. I'm not sure they were all necessarily conscious always of what they were doing, but when it turned out right, they saw it. They saw why it turned out right, mm-hmm. and then continued to do other things and to use what's right, what turns out right, and discard what doesn't.
Okay.
And so it's a lot of writing is actually rewriting.
Oh.
There are very few people who would publish the first piece of stuff that they put out. It cannot, you go back, your initial inspiration certainly is there. You grasp that, you get it, you put it there, and then you go back and you shape it, you polish it, and so on and so forth.
Okay, I see, yeah. When you're writing a book, you have to obviously research or...
Yeah.
Some books
require less research than others. For example, my novel Spirits in the Dark began with a very fundamental question, an existential question, and a lot of my writing comes out of an existential angst. Mm-hmm. And that question was, who is a West Indian? Here I was living in Canada, in a country that certainly wasn't my own. And I'd come from the Caribbean, and I had all sorts of questions roiling in my mind about the Caribbean and about the society I'd grown up with and so on. And so that question, who was a West Indian, who is a West Indian, came to mind. And I never really truly realized that Spirits in the Dark was my attempt at answering the question until I wrote the version of it that was published 10 years later in 1993. So all of my writing, I think, is in one way or another connected with this question of identity.
Indian. Who's a West Indian, right?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
And in order to do that, mm-hmm. I had to go to Africa.
Okay.
Not literally physically, though I did go afterwards, but I went to Africa by way of books.
Right.
It's a significant component of Spirits in the Dark is a trip made by some Ghanaians to the island, Isabella Island. And that is how, in fact, and that trip, those boys elucidate for my protagonist, Jerome, in a sense, a substantial component of his identity mm-hmm. that had actually moved underground. Now, interestingly enough, Jerome's father is in touch with that particular component of African identity. In fact, it is his mission to protect and promote it. And Jerome, as an educated colonial, had already rejected that. And was indeed ill in part because of that. And it is only when he is made aware of this, when he comes in touch with it, when he comes in touch with its healing component, that he is to some extent made whole.
Mm. Talking about healing, do you find writing soothing, therapeutic for you?
In a sense, I think Freud makes this statement. He says all art comes out of, he doesn't use the word agony, but that's what I think he means. He says the writer, the artist is in a state of disequilibrium and he goes to his art, mm-hmm. or he creates art in order to regain that equilibrium. And I think it's Robert Graves who says that the pearl is what the oyster creates to lessen the pain, to temper the pain of the grain of sand in its flesh. Mm-hmm. And so, in a sense, art can be therapeutic.
Definitely, yes.
And so on. And I'm thinking of one novel of mine in particular, Return to Arcadia, that did that for me. And certainly the title story in my collection, How Loud Can the Village Cock Crow? That short story was an imaginary way of dealing with the traumatic relationship I had with my father.
Wow.
And I remember writing it. I spent an entire evening and night writing it, and I think I finished somewhere around 4 o'clock in the morning. And I remember putting my head on my desk and I howled.
Oh, wow. I'm sure. Yes.
Yes.
Next question for you. When writing fiction, how do you select the names of your characters?
They come at random. There are contexts, though. I have one character whose name is definitely symbolic, mm-hmm. and I never knew it was symbolic. And I wondered to what extent my subconscious was working. And it's the name Jerome.
Okay.
And Saint Jerome was a patron saint of writers.
Oh. Wow.
And Jerome is someone who is fascinated by books and writing and. And in fact, that's actually how the novel begins. It's with hearing the story of Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves and going to join the library so that he can find other books that tell fascinating stories and his relationship with the librarian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you see his love, that love of words that I referred to earlier on in my own life, is there with Jerome. Anyway, his name is symbolic, but I don't know how I ended up choosing it. The pointer in Spirits in the Dark is Pointer Francis, and I'm sure I was thinking of Saint Francis when I chose that name. So, yeah, that's Saint Francis was better known to me.
Would you say that Jerome has a little bit of characteristics of your own self?
Well, his questing mind, certainly.
Yes.
His love of language, his love of books.
Yes.
His ambivalence vis-a-vis the society, vis-a-vis his own class. Those were all things that were probably there looming in the background that I obviously had to deal with and come to terms with and so on and so forth. My father's situation, was not exactly a pleasant one, and was to a large extent, I think I was ashamed of it, and that is largely, that's how Jerome responds to his own family. He loves his mother, but he's ashamed of his family until he actually goes through that spiritual transformation and realizes how valuable they are.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And in essence, Jerome has no reason to be ashamed of his father and his mother. They are very good, wonderful people. It's just that they're not of the class that he probably wanted them to belong to, which is somewhat different from my own situation vis-a-vis my father's family.
Okay. All right. So have you written any more books based on your family or people in your circle of friends?
I am working on a series of poems now. I've always had trouble with the notion of writing a memoir. And there's just so much there that is painful. And I tend not to want to have to answer questions that are autobiographical. And while I know that these experiences should really be put on paper,
yes,
I am not sure whether I want to respond to them. And yet, I listen to people talk about their experiences on radio, on television, et cetera, painful experiences. And they're out there in the public. And I wonder where they find the courage to do it, because I have trouble doing that. So right now, I'm writing a series of poems that are all true about my father, primarily. And there's one too as well about my grandfather. And I've written, they're mostly all written now, in the sort of like towards the final stage of revision. And I don't know if I will ever have them published.
Oh, really?
No, I don't know.
Okay. All right. Maybe one day someone might find them. And
well, yeah, yes, they'll be part of my archive.
Yeah.
When I'm dead, I'll be giving my papers to Concordia University, so you know people will have access to all of that. They'll also have access to my journals.
Oh wow!
In which I lay myself bare as I can be.
Wow. Okay.
My journals are like, are as if I were a psychoanalyst analyzing myself. That's
wow, that deep, eh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Awesome. So maybe eventually down the road, you might build up the confidence to write your own memoirs or your autobiography.
Just maybe. But I find fiction much more interesting.
I think so. Yes, because it's almost it could be that you're writing about yourself in someone else through someone.
Yeah, right. So you can. There is stuff that you can. There is the story and the interpretation of the story,
right.
That the fictional, you know, combines.
Okay. How many hours a day? I know you talked about when you were writing, was it Return of the Arcadia, that you were up very late writing that. On an average, how long?
Not Return to Arcadia, How Loud Can the Village Cock
Crow? Oh, how long? Okay.
Yeah. There's an odd time when I could actually, and this is really the odd time, when I could probably spend 12 hours.
Really?
Writing something. I have a short story in When the Bottom Falls Out, the very, very last story in the collection. And I wrote that in one sitting. And it took me about 12 hours.
12 hours.
And I remember doing it in 2014.
Okay.
But that is highly unusual.
Mm-hmm.
I don't usually spend more than 5 hours, and I don't write every day.
Okay.
If I have momentum, I will get up enthusiastically and begin to write. But most of the time when I don't have that momentum, I'm really actually thinking about my characters, jotting down notes and things like that, rather than sitting down and writing.
Okay. Tell me, really, how does it work? I have never written before. So how do you get your plot, you'll get your characters, you know, when you're deciding on writing, tell me what's the procedure?
Usually a character comes to me.
Mm-hmm.
My best analogy for this is actually the gestation process.
Okay.
The character comes to me. Almost like a gamete. Gamete, the union of the sperm and the egg.
Right. Yes, yes.
And I have to then, my knowledge plus whatever research I do, then become the womb, as it were, and the nourishment that creates that allows that gamete to mature into something that is born.
Interesting. So how long, on average, does it take you to complete a book?
Sometimes it can take forever. Spirits in the Dark, for example, I wrote the first version of it in less than a year.
Okay.
That's a version from which a small section was published. And then from 1993 until I think 1991, I kept thinking about it. I had other projects I was working on, you know, a PhD, my first job as a university prof and all of that. And in 1991, actually 1990, and I remember thinking in 88 that I will write this book, revise this book, but I needed a computer that could hold the entire manuscript together. And I did get that computer, I think in 89, and in 1990 I sat down. I'd gone to Yale to do some research in the early part of the year. In the early part of the summer, and I remember getting back to Quebec City in July. And in July and August, I wrote it and never stopped. I completely in July and August, and so on. So in a sense, I made notes over an 8-year period, a 7-year period. And then all of that just came together.
Wow.
I wrote it very, very quickly in 1990, because I already knew where I was going, what I was going to do over those years.
Wow.
Now, my second novel, it was written relatively quickly, but I had issues getting it published. There were all sorts of, it was going to the publisher, they were asking for changes, and eventually they ended up never publishing it because Heinemann decided to drop the Caribbean Writer series when the last version was supposed to come out. But that took a while. I would say it took about another 9 years or so before that went. My third novel, I sat on it for about 9 years, working off and on. Remember, I was a university prof during those years.
Okay.
And it wasn't easy to write during the school year.
Sure, yeah.
Meetings, class preps, academic research, because I was a literature professor, not a creative writing teacher.
Okay.
And so it was my scholarly work that was valuable for promotion, not my creative writing.
Mm-hmm. See.
And so on. And I think in 95 was when I decided I would lessen the creative writing. I would lessen scholarly work and focus on creative writing. And that was based on a life-changing situation. I was diagnosed with cancer in 1994.
Oh, wow.
And I had to then ask myself, what was important in my life? Mm-hmm. I didn't know how much longer I had to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, well, what is important? And I came to the conclusion that writing the novels that I wanted, writing the fiction that I wanted was more important than creative writing. Mm-hmm. But I'd already done a fair amount of so-called academic research to ensure my promotion so that it wasn't an issue. What became an issue is that I stopped applying for research grants.
Oh, okay.
Because that meant that I would have to then manage students and a whole lot of other
things.
Which
was a bit stressful, added to your situation.
Exactly,
okay.
Exactly. And then I decided I would retire early, as soon as I was able to live. I had a pension I could live off.
Right.
And just devote myself to writing, yeah.
Excellent, awesome. So I just want to go back to the cancer. How are you today?
I'm still battling it.
Okay.
Because it's one of those cancers that can't be cured, but it can be controlled.
Okay, that's good to know. Very good.
Yeah.
Awesome. And from the books that you have written, which book did you enjoy writing the most, and why?
I think it's Return to Arcadia, my third novel, and it's my perhaps the least successful of my early books. It was a novel that always felt autobiographical, although there isn't a scrap of autobiography okay. in it. And I can never explain why that novel felt autobiographical. It may very well have to do with my own inner conflicts. I'm almost sure of that, because writing is like dreaming, you know. You have your unresolved issues during the day.
Yes.
And at night, your subconscious reconfigures those issues, and you dream about them sometimes.
Yes.
Dreams that you can recognize, at other times not. So I suspect writing does that as well, because in a way, writing fiction is like dreaming wide awake. Return to Arcadia was the book that challenged me most, and it's the book that when I finished writing it, I was most satisfied about. And generally, literary types who have read my work agree that it's my best book.
Okay, and that's the one that I'm going to read.
I warn you.
You do, it do.
It's a difficult book.
Okay.
Yeah. When people approach my work for the first time, I tell them to read my second novel, Behind the Face of Winter.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
So what one thing would you give up to become a better writer?
I don't know. One of the things I do, or I should do more, is read works that are difficult to read. And I'm thinking of Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow, for example, or Marlene Nubesi Phillips's Zong, and so on. Difficult poetry, for example, falls into that category as well. On the other hand, I don't want to go too far in that area.
Okay.
Because I share William Wordsworth's view, as well as Chinua Achebe's, the late Chinua Achebe, right, Nigerian writer, that the poet, Wordsworth says, is a man speaking to other men. We can upgrade that to a human being speaking to other human beings. And Chinua Achebe, in his essay, Morning Yet on Creation Day, says that the African writer has no choice but to be a teacher. And I could add to that as well, Matthew Arnold, who felt that poetry, or you could say literature, broadly speaking, because that's what he meant, will probably have to play the role that religion once did.
Interesting.
In other words, writers should take their craft very seriously. W.B. Yeats says that as well. That, in a sense, puts me in a bind, because it makes me realize that I have to write in a style that is accessible to all who might want to read my book. And so on. And I have a fascination for simple language. Not simple concepts, but simple language.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. So there is all of that that is thrown into the mix. But at the same time, as I said, I enjoy reading difficult stuff, because in a way, it's sort of like it challenges me.
I see, right. Definitely, mm-hmm. Yeah. So talking about poems and poetry, why not at this time, you know, go ahead and share with us one of your poems?
Yes, I thought I was looking for a short one. This one's called At the Maternity Ward.
And when did you write this one?
It was written about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay. At the Maternity Ward. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. And you would see here, it contains some of my preoccupations.
Okay.
And I read, At the Maternity Ward. Here, wombs planted 9 months ago are stretched to max and must deliver. Seed buried in the dark, where even the universe began, comes into the light transformed. Those the wise farmer sows, he greets with golden eyes. The fecunding sperms, the agilest of millions, the egg is solitary. Nature draws her frontiers, not always wisely. At the door, exiting women and men hold bassinets of joy. They might or might not have chosen to carry, but will 4 years as joy and groan and sometimes grief. All life begins in the dark, and what it grows into remains mostly in the dark.
Mm. Love that. And where can we find that piece?
It's not published.
Okay. You have collection of short poems, short stories. You have a collection of that already, don't you?
I have a collection of poems, and this one, if it's accepted, would be included in a collection that I hope to offer to the publishers sometime soon. That's why I'm agonizing about those poems about my father.
Okay.
Yeah. Do I include them or do I not include them?
I see. Okay. One question I forgot to ask you was, before you got into writing, what were you doing prior to writing? You were a professor?
I was a mental health worker for part-time from 1970 to 1976. But during those years while I worked part-time, I went to the university for the most part full-time. And then I began to teach high school, initially English and later French in 76.
Do you find that you write anything pertaining to your experience working in the mental health?
My novel Return to Arcadia would not have been written if I had not had the experience of if I hadn't had some psychiatric training.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It is set in large part on a psychiatric ward. My novel Behind the Face of Winter is actually the novel of mine that references reality most, because I reprise in it several of the incidents that occurred while I was a high school teacher, and I reprise them in almost a verbatim fashion, and so on and so forth. Yeah, it's a documentation in large measure of what went on in Montreal's high schools while I taught.
Right now there's a big conversation in the news regarding Black Lives Matter. But I just wanted to know, how do you feel about that? Is that something that maybe you might write about?
I reference it in a couple of my poems that I've revised, that I'm revising for publication. I do have a poem on the banks of the St. Lawrence, Dusk or something like that, on the banks of the St. Lawrence River.
Okay.
And in it I mentioned George Floyd. Black Lives Matter is to me a part of the phenomenon of what it is. This is, how do I put it? It's hard to put it. I see it not just in the moment. I see it in the broader spectrum of human existence on this planet. We have always, as human beings, we're just another species of animals, and all animals battle, it seems, among themselves for territory. And part of that is racism. And the question with humans is how reason tempers instinct, and so on and so forth. And what in fact Black Lives Matter is doing, and has to do and must do, is appeal to the reason of those who would oppress them. You know, the love of power is something that is found in the human species.
Yes.
It's found in animals as well. But among us, we use reason, we use our intellect to facilitate the acquisition of power. And invariably, when we have it, we like to remind ourselves that we have it. And in order to remind ourselves that we have it, we do things to those over whom we have power to make sure that they understand that we have power over them. And so the resistance has to be there, and it has to be constant. If you don't, in fact, for me, life is a struggle at the individual level. And what it is now in terms of Black Lives Matter is at the collective level. And one of the things that I find encouraging is the number of people who normally would belong to the oppressing group who have joined themselves to the struggle for equality and justice with the oppressed group.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's how I look at the whole thing.
Well, thank you for sharing. Yeah, I had an interview with a Caucasian lady, and she has formed a book club where they are trying to consciously be aware of some of the things that they didn't really realize were racist, and
yeah,
that they're making themselves accountable for their actions. And I thought that was really a good step. You know, we have
all the innocent jokes.
Mm-hmm.
They're all the questions that and so on. Some of them quite vicious. People used to come up to me in Quebec City and say, "Oh, monsieur, you're here. Are you a student at Laval?" And all of a sudden, what underlies that question is that, well, we don't have Black people working here, so you have to be a student at Laval. The other question to that is, the Blacks who are here temporarily,
mm-hmm,
they're not here, and so on and so forth. And when they find out that, no, you're not a student at Laval, you're in fact a prof there,
mm-hmm,
then comes another question. You mean to tell me they couldn't find a Canadian to give that job to?
Oh, wow, really?
Okay. So you see, what began seemingly innocently,
yeah,
had a whole racial underlay. And they felt quite confident and secure that they could say that to me without any repercussion whatsoever.
Wow.
What they were doing is they were showing me what that is a display of power.
I hear you. Well, moving on and getting back to books and your writings. you are coming out with another book, you said, next year.
Yes, indeed. And it is part of a quartet. It began actually just as one novel, No Safeguards. And then shortly before I finished second or the third draft, I realized that, no, there was a lot here that's going on. And many characters that needed to come to life. And so there's the first volume, which is simply called No Safeguards. And then the second volume, Fate's Instruments, No Safeguards 2. Next year, there'll be No Safeguards 3, which is called Easily Fooled. And I'll just give you a little bit. It's the story of a gay Methodist, ex-Methodist minister.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And he is, who has actually lost his faith. And he is here in Montreal, actually, having trouble finding a job and married to a fellow from his village, who is actually the protagonist in the first volume. and agonizing over how he is going to reveal his marriage to his mother, whom he knows is a homophobe. Yeah, so that essentially is what drives the third volume of
that book.
The fourth volume is already written, but of course I haven't offered it to the publishers yet.
Sure. Okay, interesting. Very interesting. Looking forward to your book's coming out next year. Is there any time frame next year? Do you know?
I think they were thinking of spring, but now with COVID, I'm not quite sure what it has done to their publishing schedule.
What's your target audience when you write? Do you have a target audience?
I honestly don't have one. And I saw a documentary on Toni Morrison about two or three weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, I write to please myself. I won't quite put it that way. I write because, I mean, I don't choose what I write. In a word, it's the characters choose me. They come to me like that. Mm-hmm. Like if, for example, how your dreams come to you, you can't control them.
Right.
And the characters come to me like that, and they stay. And they stay, and they stay, and they stay. And when a character has stayed with me for like weeks, and I'm beginning actually to write them in my head, I know I have to sit down and write.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually how I began writing fiction. I remember I was teaching high school, and these characters would come to me, and I started writing fiction around 82. The characters would come to me, and while I'm in bed, and I would lie there and actually would be writing the story in my head, and then I look at the clock, and it's 3 a.m., and I have to get up at 6. And so something said, well, you know, you better write these things down and get the stuff out of you and in order so that you can sleep. And that's exactly how I started writing fiction. And some of those stories were actually good, because most of them ended up in How Loud Can the Village Call Crow, which for West Indians is my most popular book. Everybody, once they read or hear about it, they want copies to send. A woman bought 10 copies for me to give to her friends.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And those stories. Yes. So, yeah. Okay. All of this is a long-winded way of saying that the characters come to me. I don't actually go looking for them.
Sure, right. I hear you. So, with that said, do you sleep with a notepad beside your bed?
It's there, but I rarely use it. Okay. Though I did use it about 2 weeks ago for something. It was a poem. And it's if it's a poem that comes to me, I have to record it right away, otherwise I will forget it. Because poems begin with images, and you're likely to forget that image if you don't record it right there and then.
So
yeah, it's there. Certainly, yes, I do have a notepad, a huge one, and several pens. Yes.
So when sleeping at night, do you ever wake out of your sleep with a thought, an idea?
Yeah, every once in a while,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, it would be as if I were dreaming, and then I would awaken, and the dream would continue.
Okay, all right. And then you start writing down.
And so I would say, oh, this is significant. Mm-hmm. And so I would get up and do it. Usually it occurs around 5, 6 in the morning.
Really? That's the timing. That's the time frame.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I'd say. So tell me, Nigel, what advice do you have for any up and coming writers?
It is simple. Mm-hmm. Read and read widely in all the genres. Pay attention to how they use language. And then pay attention to how you yourself use language. It depends on where you are, what stage you're in. If you're a beginning writer, the trick is to just write and write and write and write and not worry initially about the quality of the writing. Just write. If you're writing fiction, let the story just come out. If it's poetry, let it come out as it is. And then go back and look at it. See what's good. Extract that. And possibly discard the rest. Remember I told you that I wrote poetry for numerous years after that experience on Montreal?
Right.
I would say 9/10 of those poems were never published and will never be published because they're not good enough to be published. But 1/10 of them have been published.
Okay.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So you need the bad writing in order to liberate the good.
Right. Okay. Understood. Great. Well, thank you so much for being my guest today and sharing.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
it was really
really good to hear from an author and hear you share what inspires you, what inspired you to write, and give some information a little bit about the books that you have written. Definitely going to be looking out for your upcoming book next year. So thank you so much again for sharing. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. Let me just add to say, you know, it's kind of, I am touched that you are interviewing me. You know, it's sort of like you're the third generation of the family.
Yeah.
Beginning with the friendship that involved your grandmother, Mrs.
Yes.
Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know all about that.
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
I do.
I'm touched. Thanks again for the
opportunity. You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoy the topic and found something that you can apply to your own life. Don't forget to share this episode with your family and friends. And remember, live well daily.